The chapter we'll have under consideration tonight, Deuteronomy chapter 60, and I appreciate Logan for reading that, sort of continues the trend that we've had for the last couple chapters and chapters after this of reviewing these different aspects of the old law. There's some additional information given, some modification made in some instances, since Israel would have now a permanent dwelling place in Canaan, but we're sort of reviewing these aspects of the old law. And chapter 16 focuses mainly on the feasts, the feasts of Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. And these feasts, you might ask, you know, what the common thread is within this chapter, because there are other feasts, religious rites that aren't included in this chapter, feasts of trumpets, Day of Atonement, things like that that aren't mentioned here. And it seems, at least from what I can gather, that the theme of this chapter is feasts, activities involving pilgrimage to eventually to Jerusalem, but to the temple, to the tabernacle, the place where God would put his name. In fact, that phrase, place God chooses or puts his name, its iterations occur six times in this chapter, only 22 verses, and that occurs six times, and then the phrase before the Lord occurs three times as well. So that's sort of the theme, I guess, within this coming before the Lord, in this case for these religious feasts, as well as at the very end of the chapter, coming before the Lord are the Lord's dispensers of judgment, these judges, local judges that were to give, make decisions based on the law and to sort of adjudicate God's judgment among the people. And so that seems to be the theme, coming before the Lord in this chapter. And so this first section we'll be talking about the Passover, and question number one, Bill, this will be for you. What instructions concerning the celebration of Passover are added in Deuteronomy's account?
Well, I think it's tied into the phrase in verse 2 that reads, in the place where the Lord chooses to put his name. This phrase has continued to come up ever since, I think chapter 12, verse 5 was the first time it was used. This idea of the Lord's going to choose a place. And so I think that's the most important instruction. The Passover feast wasn't to be observed in each family's home, as in the beginning coming out of Egypt, but where the Lord chooses to put his name. That's what I locked in on as the instruction that was added in the Deuteronomy account. Things of interest, at least what I thought was interesting, was this word herd, and it does mean cattle. There's a writer named Klein, and he explained that the word Passover here includes the Passover proper and the seven-day feast of unleavened bread. This was when, and you know, the Passover was sheep, lambs, and goats, the young male of the, only the sheep and the goats could be the Passover sacrifices of Exodus chapter 12 and verse 5. So the idea of herd being mentioned here and meaning cattle, that must have been the animals that could have been sacrificed the days after the Passover. You know, think about thousands of people being gathered, maybe tens of thousands of people being gathered, and this would be an opportunity for other sacrificing to be done. And that's maybe, it makes sense, that could be the way to explain the word herd being used here, is that it was after the actual Passover.
Interesting. Yeah, it is difficult in this section because, as you said, Passover is kind of used interchangeably. When I think of Passover, I think of the lamb, the feast, and the blood, and all that. It's used here in regard to the whole shebang, essentially the whole seven-day feast. A couple small observations while people think. This word Abib is translated as young ears of corn. So it's this idea of first fruits. So this month would have been late March, maybe early April. So it's a spring harvest. And so this is the first fruits. Yes, the first fruits. And then there's an interesting, I think it's this section. Never mind, that's later on. Got ahead of myself. Anyone else want to add? Well, there is a seeming contradiction in this section. I don't know if anyone else read this, but it seems from verse 1, it says, the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. And there's some people that seize on that, because in Exodus 12:22, Israel was given specific instructions to not leave the house after Passover until morning, or they'd be killed. And we know from Exodus 13:3 that Israel actually departed in the morning. And so some people look to this as a contradiction within the Bible. It seems that the best explanation is that Pharaoh gave his permission, you remember, at night. He went to Moses, or Moses went to him, I don't remember, at night. And so that's when the deliverance started, and then the actual, the physical departure ended up going in the morning. And so it's in that sense, or perhaps it's a figurative sense as well, that aspect of being in a night departure. But different ways to explain that. Anyone else? All right, then. Question two. Trace, this one will be for you. The Feast of Weeks included a free will offering. How were the Israelites to determine what they would give for this tribute to the Lord?
Well, the Feast of Weeks is also known as the Feast of Harvest, the Feast of the First Fruits, and the Feast of Ingathering. To me, I was having a hard time figuring out where to find that exactly. I'm sure it's probably in Exodus or Leviticus or both, but the best of my knowledge, it seemed like a collection or a tithe, so 10% of whatever they had. I'm not 100% sure about that, but that's what I gathered out of it.
Yeah, just to go back, I skipped a little bit on the previous question. So those instructions for the Passover, Feast of Passover, are in Exodus 12 and Leviticus 23, and one other thing that I found is the difference, the blood. It's supposed to be on the altar in this case versus the doorpost earlier. But yes, the free will offering, it's not specified, I don't think. But yes, it's a voluntary offering that people were to give as they've been prospered, essentially. Bart?
Yeah, so it specifies it's a free will offering there. And I think there's a direct correlation with the Lord's Day. Because, as Trace pointed out, it's the first fruits. And, you know, essentially it is the Passover, Pentecost, the celebration of the Pentecost. That's the name in Greek that it's renamed, because it's 7 weeks plus one after Passover. So Passover occurs, then you count 7 weeks, as we've learned before, and then you add one, and that brings you to Pentecost, or the feast, you know, the Feast of Weeks. And that's the beginning of the wheat harvest. And so that is the day the church was established. The day of Pentecost, of course, Acts chapter 2, is when the church was established. And we're told to give as we have been prospered on the first day of the week. And so there's a direct, I think there's a direct correlation there. It says here, as the Lord blesses you. And there's other comparisons with the beginning of the church that we've noted before in the past as well. It's believed by the Jews, although the Bible doesn't specifically say, but the Jews record that Moses gave the law. Moses came down from Sinai on this Pentecost day. So he came down from Sinai with the Ten Commandments, and of course there were the events of that. People were having a party, and Moses cast the stone tablets down, and then 3,000 Jews died on that day, that first Pentecost there. But then, when the new covenant was given, the church was established. Jesus gave the law to the church, and 3,000 people were baptized. And so I love the correlation between those two. And also fire came down. Now, fire came down on Sinai. Fire came down upon the disciples as they received the Holy Spirit. So I love the fact that this Feast of Pentecost, that they go to rejoice at and give free will offering, is associated with the beginning of the church.
Yeah, it looks very good. I call that spiritual nourishment in this case. There's this free will offering, but as you mentioned, a connection with the law giving to commemorate that aspect of it. Lauren?
Verse 16, it had to be something. It can't even appear empty-handed. And verse 10, then you have an idea that it's in proportion to what the Lord is welcome.
Very good. Bart mentioned first fruits as well. I thought it was interesting. I hadn't thought about this before, but on the second day of Passover, there was a sheaf of barley that was supposed to be offered according to Leviticus 23:15. And then the second day of Pentecost, there's a sheaf of new wheat that's offered as a first fruits here, and we read that in Numbers 28:26. And so again, just to go back to what Bart said, that's an aspect of these feasts as well, giving as you've been prospered. Just if you're curious, the required offerings for the Feast of Weeks or Passover are discussed in Numbers 28. If you want to go back and look at the minimum that the people were required to give for this. So this is beyond that. As the question mentioned, the Feast of Weeks included a freewill offering. That wasn't the whole thing. That was just going above and beyond, essentially. I like the way Keelan DeLitch summarized this section on the Feast of Pentecost. They said that Israel was to sacrifice as they've been blessed, to rejoice before God with others, including the poor, and that was a theme of the past couple chapters as well, the poor in meals and perhaps songs. Some people consider that word rejoice to have a musical component, a singing before the Lord. But to sacrifice as they've been blessed, to rejoice before the Lord with others, and then to remember that they were all slaves in Egypt, blessed by God. And so I think those three things are central and a really good way to think about the point of this Feast of Pentecost, to hit those three things as the children of Israel, to provide for the poor, to give back, and then to remember where they've come from. And certainly, as Bart connected to, a giving for us, all the same applies to us. Anyone else? Okay. Question three then, moving right along, Dennis. This one will be for you. Why should rejoicing be associated with the Feast of Tabernacles?
Well, I just connected rejoicing with Thanksgiving. Being rejoicing would reflect an attitude of being grateful for what God has blessed them with, along with the quantity of that blessing. I just thought of some passages, Psalm 23, Psalm 50, verse 23, then New Testament, 1 Thessalonians 5:18. Give thanks in all circumstances, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus, Colossians 3:17. And whatever you do, whether in word or deed, do it in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, giving thanks to God the Father through His Son. Rejoicing, connected with giving thanks, it would be very difficult to, if you were doing that properly, your whole demeanor would be not on yourself. I didn't do this. That's not for my hard work. I did work hard, but God is blessing us. And so we're rejoicing on how He has provided for us.
Yeah, very good. I read a really interesting comment on that. I don't know exactly whether or not it's true. I don't remember what commentary it was, but one writer said that Israel didn't allow any marriages at this time. And I don't know if it was just Feast of Tabernacles or all the feasts, but the point was that they didn't want personal or private joy, familial joy, to overshadow public and national rejoicing that was supposed to be the focus. So again, whether or not that's true, I don't know, but everything was supposed to stop. That was supposed to be the focal point of everyone's week, these different feasts. As Dennis said, that was the idea that you would be so full of rejoicing, and not personally as well as in a nationalistic sense. And this was to bring the people together. The people were to pilgrimage to eventually Jerusalem, but wherever the Lord would put His name in the meantime, come together and then to essentially worship, to rejoice together, to share meals together, whatever, to give, to worship in a sacrificial sense. And so that seems to be the theme, as Dennis said, that rejoicing had to have been contagious. It had to have been something that really would have stirred the people up, hopefully, to stay faithful to the Lord, even though we know that didn't happen many times. You want to add that, Bart?
Yeah, I couldn't help thinking of all the times the boys asked to sleep out in the backyard when they were growing up, and I'm sad to say didn't do that nearly as much as I should have. And how excited they are about sleeping out, and they used to be about sleeping out in the backyard. And this is still a national event that occurs in Israel, and I read a little bit about it, and the most interesting fact I learned was that they still build huts. Now they use modern materials, mesh materials and all. But the nation of Israel has regulations that the roof, there has to be so much space so that you can see out of the roof and see the stars at night as you're laying out. And so I just, sometimes we study this and we don't really get the big picture about what it would be like for the nation if, a lot of times the men's perhaps would just go, but then that time would come when the dad would say, okay, we're all going this year, and all the kids would go and they would stay. And imagine being in the city where all the people are staying outside in the streets, and then you know, parking lots, what we consider parking lots, and everybody's this is festive, and you know, period. And as you stated, this seems to have been the festival where there was the most rejoicing, and you know, it was a national focus.
I think verse 15. I'll get you through it, sorry. Verse 15, I think, is sort of encapsulates all that. At the very end of that verse, it says in the New King James, "So that you surely rejoice." You do all these things, you keep it as a feast, so that you surely rejoice. And that phrase literally means rejoicing only. So that's the idea here. That's all you can do, essentially, is rejoice. So that you rejoice only. That's your purpose for that week. That's what's on your mind. That's what you're about for that week. And so certainly that would have been an amazing thing to be a part of. Grant?
This also seems to come after a time of a lot of hard work. They just cleaned off the threshing floor, cleaned off the wine press. They put all this hard work, and all of a sudden now it's time to relax. Now they can rejoice.
Yeah, very good. It was probably part of the reason for rejoicing.
See, I looked at it a little different. I looked at the tabernacles as that was a reminder of the poor conditions. I'm in this. Or me and maybe the boys are in this tabernacle, and I'm not really crazy. I don't like it. It's cramped. The boys are stinking, and that's the part that's reminding me of Egypt. And when we get to verse 15, so that you surely rejoice, I saw that as we're out of the tabernacle. We're going to rejoice and have a party.
Yeah. There's a component to all these feasts as well of remembering the spiritual blessings and keeping that focus for God and giving back and giving to the poor and all that. But yeah, there's also a thread throughout of remembering where you came from. And that's been repeated almost ad nauseum through the book of Deuteronomy so far. Remember, you were in Egypt, you were a slave, you were oppressed, and then do all these things because of that. Keep these feasts. Take care of the poor. Do all the things that weren't done for you. Remember that God took you out of that, and to bear all that in mind going forward, to keep them on the straight and narrow. Lauren?
Back in Leviticus, there was a good verse about that. It says, "You shall dwell in," this is Leviticus 23, 42 and 43. It says, "You shall dwell in booths for 7 days. All who are native Israelites shall dwell in the booths, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in the booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." So, you know, they're the native Israelites. It was really specifically says that it was for a national remembrance.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Anything else? All right. Question 4, backstretch. Matt, this one will be for you then. How important were the 3 feasts mentioned in this chapter to be for Israel, and what special actions set them apart from other holy days?
I'll start by answering the second part of the question, mainly because it's already been covered. These are pilgrimage feasts. The men in Israel and their families would journey to the place that the Lord would set aside for them to perform these feasts and to celebrate these moments 3 times a year. And I find it interesting that they happen kind of in order that they happened in the Exodus. They happened with the Passover, which was in Egypt, followed by Pentecost, which is at Sinai, and then the Feast of the Harvest, or the Feast of Tabernacles, which happened in the wilderness, and they happened in that order during the year as well. And as far as the importance of these events goes, it's been pretty well covered here, but so I won't rehash a whole lot of that. But you have the Passover, which was the children were saved, the families were spared from the Lord as he came and took the firstborn of those in Egypt. You have Pentecost, the deliverance of the law, and then the Feast of Tabernacles is interesting because they're kind of in a midway point. They're not slaves in Egypt, and they're not in the Promised Land yet. So they kind of have that dichotomy to look at. They can look back and say, we were slaves, and then they can look forward and say, we have this Promised Land coming for us.
Good. Who else? It's this phrase of the men in verse 16, 3 times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord. It's been used at least twice already in the writings of Moses, Exodus 34:23 and 23:17. And throughout it, that's the theme. You have these main 3 feasts, and all Israel, all the men are supposed to come before the Lord where he would put his name.
I looked at them from being so important, as you just said, they were so important that all the men had to travel. I mean, I found myself when I was studying on it, thinking about, we're leaving home, and I mean, it's for extended periods of time. Chores aren't going to get, you know, things that you're leaving at home and the risk. You know, again, to me, it's another opportunity for the people to demonstrate their trust in the Lord.
Well, that's perhaps part of the reason that women were exempt from this, in order to allow them to stay home to oversee infants or children that were too young or sick to travel, take care of the crops and livestock, and sort of go off what Bart uses as an example earlier. Perhaps there was sort of a rotation. You know, if you live in this small village or city, you know, maybe families sort of took turns who would get to go to which feast every year to make sure somebody was there to provide or to take care of the livestock, the crops, whatever needed done. A couple other ideas as to why, you know, this might have been important. I guess that's not one of the questions, but I think we've talked about it in the past. These national feasts were to maintain unity. That was one of the reasons among the tribes when Israel goes into Canaan, they segregate, go into these different regions, and some of which are pretty far apart, wouldn't really interact with perhaps a tribe that's all the way across Canaan. But so this was allowing the people to get back together, to reconnect with those roots of traveling together, being together, regardless of tribe, in that common bond. It also helped people reminded them of the importance and that connection they needed to have to the priesthood. Again, it's easy, I think, for us to forget, you know, living in the day and age that we do, that going to the temple, making this sacrifice, having that connection to the priesthood was something people didn't really do very often. You did it maybe 3 times a year. And so, but making sure the Levites were central in the mind of God's people, not just for the people's sake, but for the Levites' sake as well, so that they would be remembered, provided for by the people, because we know throughout Israel's history they weren't. Many times they were neglected. So that was another aspect, perhaps, of why these feasts were bound on the men of Israel. Anything else? Okay. Question 5, Grant. This one will be for you. Why was integrity and a proper sense of justice among Israel's judges tied to inheriting the land?
All right. Now, the land was, of course, where God's house was, his temple was. And the people that are there are his children, and it reflects upon how people see God as far as how his children treat each other, how the Israelites treat each other. Similarly to those who are parents, have kids, the way our kids try to treat each other in our house is a reflection upon how we ourselves are often seen. So how God would be seen upon by the other nations, it's certainly how people are treating each other here. Of course, it's also reflected in the New Testament, how we treat each other in the church. We treat each other equally, we treat each other honestly. We don't defraud anybody. And this is reflected upon how people see the church. So how people will see God is how people see how we treat each other.
Yeah. These officials were to sort of act essentially as Moses had so long ago. And then the men that he appointed in Exodus chapter 18 in the wilderness to act as these sort of intermediary judges, but to act on a local level when Israel was dispersed in Canaan, yeah, to be that sort of representative of dispensing God's justice among the people. A couple of things, verse by verse, that I thought were a little bit interesting. There's some neat stuff in this section. In verse 18, it says, "You shall appoint judges and officers in all your gates." And I thought it was neat that word officers means writers. It is what the Hebrew word means. And so it's referring to clerks or secretaries. So that might not sound like a big important thing for us. Everybody reads and writes essentially today, but back then there weren't a lot of people who were literate, who had the materials to be able to read, to write, to record. And they also would have counseled, no doubt, with the judges. So this was an important position. This wasn't judges and throwaway positions that anybody could have done. This was a very important thing, a scribe, essentially a legal scribe among the people. Verse 19, verse 19, when it talks about the words of the righteous, you shall not pervert justice, at the very end, twist the words of the righteous. That words means matters, a case, a cause. So it's not saying, you know, you'll twist their testimony necessarily and make that into something it's not, but to twist the course of justice, essentially, not to pervert justice among God's people. And it's interesting, I read one commentator that mentioned this. I hadn't thought of it, but apparently in this region, it's customary, at least back in that day, to take bribes, not necessarily even in a perverting justice sense, but if you took gifts essentially from the side that was in the right, as a judge, you know, that was seen as an okay thing. You were still a just judge if you took gifts from the person who was legally in the right, because then you were just getting compensated essentially for your work. That's how they rationalized it. So God is trying to keep any sort of custom that might tempt people even to pervert the course of justice out of the legal system altogether with that prohibition. Yeah, Lauren?
God's blessings were contingent on the justice was in the land. Mm-hmm. And like you said, that, you know, you weren't supposed to show partiality. Back in Deuteronomy 1 and 17, mm-hmm. there's an explicit command not to show partiality. And then later on, that is some of the reasons why God's blessing was taken from Israel. In Amos 5:10, it says, they hate the one who rebukes in the gate, and they abhor the one who speaks uprightly. Therefore, because you tread down the poor and take grain taxes from him, though you have built houses of hewn stone, yet you shall not dwell in them. You have planted pleasant vineyards, but you shall not drink wine from them. Mm. So once that corrupt mentality got into Israel, those blessings were taken away.
Mark?
Yeah, and just to draw the obvious correlation, this is like qualifications for elders in this chapter, and there's a direct correlation with qualifications for elders in the church, because obviously, as we've made the point over and over again, these people are entering into the promised land. We are in the true promised land. The physical land is a type, and we have inherited the church as Gentiles. That is the true promised land. Everything that's happening to these individuals is a type of what is happening to us. And so when these qualifications are laid down for the judges, it's a direct correlation with 1 Timothy 3, where the elders are to be pure and blameless and not greedy for money and so on. Mm. And as far as the connection, I totally agree with what Lauren says about it's contingent upon being just and righteous and all. And that's true for us. You know, if we are wicked and evil and unjust in our lives, then we're cast out. We may not be cast out of the physical church because there may not be church discipline put against us, but God certainly will cast us out. And I thought of James when I was thinking about this. I thought about James 1 and 27. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their trouble, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. If we become spotted and defile ourselves, then we no longer inherit the promised land.
Mm-hmm. And one other thing to think about potentially. In verse 18, it just says, you shall appoint judges. So this wasn't something the way we appoint judges where, you know, we have a majority vote. This was chosen, these judges were chosen by local leaders, presumably by the people that were the most powerful within the tribe. We'd like to think maybe it was the most righteous, but many times that probably wasn't the case. And so this was appointed, and again, maybe there's a connection to elders as well within that. But a couple things, anything else? Dennis?
Yeah, I thought about this word abomination. Mm-hmm. Deuteronomy 25, 13 through 16 tells us that a perverted, this kind of paraphrase there, perverted sense of justice is an abomination of the Lord. And Deuteronomy 18, 12 says that people who were losing their land to the Israelites were an abomination to the Lord. And so they were losing their land there. And then, let's see here. Yeah, I'm going to just read that. 25:13. You shall not have in your bag differing weights, heavy and light. You shall not have in your house differing measures, large and small. You shall not have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure, that you days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord your God has given you. For all who do such things, all who give wrongfully, are an abomination to the Lord.
I think of verse, well, I guess there are only three within this section, but verse 20 really, I think, encapsulates the point. What we read as you shall follow what is altogether just, that phrase is really only two words in Hebrew, and it's the same word twice. The Hebrew literally is just justice. Justice, that you may live and inherit the land. Justice, only justice, essentially. So that repetition is for emphasis But as has been mentioned already, to impress upon the people the importance of that aspect, that justice to them inheriting the promised land, that was a key component. And then we might ask within this section, similar to, you know, back in Exodus 18, Moses had done this already, appointed judges among the people. And then when there was a case that was too difficult, a very difficult case, then they took it to Moses, and Moses decided. And so we might say within this section, you know, what do you do? You know, these local people, what if there's a case that they can't answer? And spoilers, that's in the next chapter. In chapter 17, verses 8 to 13, there's provision given there for these cases that are too difficult and need to be appealed all the way to the priests in this case. So yeah, this from verse 18 on is kind of a transition in a sense to legal, civil matters. There's obviously some moral matters here as well, but the end of this chapter and then the start of chapter 17 is concerning crimes that should be punished in Israel. So this is an aspect of the justice system as well. So these men who were made judges, local judges, not only were they to judge in the sense of, you know, these more petty matters, but also in these matters of life and death, sometimes of false doctrine or whatever else might pop up in Israel. And then ultimately, if there was an issue, to take that to the spiritual center of Israel to get that resolved. Anything else? Okay. Last question. Question six. Lauren, this one will be for you. What kinds of trees and pillars did Moses have in mind here?
Well, I don't know that it's a specific kind of tree. It's an Asherah pole. The pillars used for idol worship. They're often a place of sacrifice, pagan sacrifice, and they're often associated with immorality. It says plant a tree, it may also mean, just like it says in the next verse, set up. So they could just set up a tree as a pole. And in Exodus 34:13, it specifically commanded Israel to break down these pillars that were set up by the Canaanites. So this is emphasis not to go back to the wicked ways that the Canaanites that they're throwing out did.
Yeah, that's an interesting discussion. So whether or not this was an actual tree or whether it was a wooden post, it kind of depends on who you read, from what I could tell. Because, yeah, some render that plant is placed. It's also interesting to think about if you were going to plant a tree, you'd have to wait, you know, at least a few decades before that tree was big enough to really do much under. This idea of green trees were mentioned a lot throughout the Old Testament. In reference to this, is referring to a tree that's luxuriant, that it's got thick, it's got a lot of foliage, so it's casting these shadows, it's very densely leaf. Hosea 4:13 mentions that aspect as well. So that's the idea of when it talks about groves, you know, having these dark sort of mystic places. Whether that's a specific type of tree in mind or that, I don't know. It seems, in fact, Hosea 4 verse 13, I think, mentions some different species of trees, the oaks, I believe, and other trees as well. So, but yeah, the point is, if it's anything for idol worship that's set up, even if, you know, you talk about the second part, the pillars aspect, you know, anything for idol worship is to be prohibited. And then we'll get to a little bit more in the next chapter. Bart?
I'll just read this verse, and then I will sit down. Jeremiah 10, verse 2. Thus says the Lord, do not learn the way of the Gentiles. Do not be dismayed by the signs of heaven, for the Gentiles are dismayed at them, for the customs of the people are futile. For one cuts a tree from the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen, with an axe. They decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with nails and hammers, so it will not. Mm-hmm. So there's no question about some of what they were doing.
I had a feeling you were going to reference that. Anybody else? The pulpit commentary, I think it was, had a really interesting take on this, because again, this seems, this last section on judges, but then we go into idol worship, essentially idolatrous worship for seemingly no reason. They say on this section that, quote, in all states, the highest crime of which the judge has to take note of is that of treason against the supreme power. Certainly that's true. And they go on to say, under the theocracy, the act most distinctly treasonous was idolatry. And so that's an interesting reason to think about why that's included here. We're talking about justice and certainly going against the leader of Israel, God himself, was the ultimate act of treason against Israel, needed to be dealt with in a legal and very brutal manner for the people involved. Anyone else? And One small note on the pillars in verse 22, this can refer to, the word actually used here is in reference to any monument. It's not necessarily a good or bad thing that's mentioned. That word explicitly, and it can even refer to wood pillars, just any sort of post or sign, but the connotation certainly here isn't just to signs in general, to monuments, to great victories or events of Israel's history, but an object of worship. That's referenced in 2 Kings 3, verse 2 as well. So again, the second point of this is nothing that's going to take the people away from God. And then the whole rest of the chapter is trying to bring the people to God, in a literal sense, I suppose, as well, bringing them before the Lord for these different feasts to strengthen spiritual Israel.